Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of It's Easy Sun, your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. And today, I have another guest, another Howard Bison, and a Bison who is moving up the line and doing some wonderful things in sports journalism, and also doing some things that I think are interesting in terms of sharing the history of, say, Howard. And we'll get into that in a minute, into a documentary or a feature that he produced recently. But a young man who has a varied background and an interesting one to show perseverance and grit and continuing to strive. And as we get into today's conversation, that will become evident. And like all my guests before, we here for about an hour, and it will be fun. His doing my research and listening to the things shared about him, I know this is going to be another good episode. So, ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, I welcome to the program, to this week, the podcast, Mr. Mark Wright. Mr. Wright, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Good afternoon, sir. Thank you so much for having me on your show, and the check is already in the mail. Thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Well, you know, if you're a Howard Bison, you know, it's pro bono, it's on credit, so you're good to go. You're good to go. Well, welcome to the podcast, and by way of ground rules, I don't speak a lot, and what I try to do is to have the audience hear about your journey and how you got to where you are today and the interesting things you've done over the course of your career thus far. Our goal here is to inspire and give people another lens through which to look at some of the things that they think they can't overcome. You know, if most of my guests can say the colloquial expression, been there, done that. And most of the audience sometimes keys in on that to say, wow, if they did it, I can do it. So we'll just jump right in with some open-ended questions. And based on your responses will be some other derivative questions from myself. And before you know it, we'll be at an hour. Is that okay?
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, let's get started. So tell us, who is Mark Wright? What grounds you? Who grounded you? And what drives your passion today?
Oh, my goodness. And we only have an hour, right?
Okay, yeah, only good. An hour.
Well, first off, let me just say that I love that this podcast and this platform is driven by inspiration and uplift. You know, when I accepted the invitation to be on this show, you know, I wanted to, you know, remind myself that I'm not on this show speaking with your growing audience to brag or to posture or to you know, doctor up stories that don't have a happy ending. So I love the uplift piece and the inspiration piece, and I pray that two of the 10 things I might say here today might touch somebody. So I'm really thankful for that. But you know, the Mark Wright story is, well, first off, my parents in Jamaica, Derek and Dorothy Wright, sister Wright and brother Wright, are in Jamaica, just both celebrated their 78th birthdays, 3 days apart.
Wow.
And they're in good health and doing well, and haven't seen them in a while, but they're doing just fine. So when you talk about who, they literally made me, and they grounded me. And I am who I am, and I am who I have become and continue to be because of brother Wright and sister Wright. So big ups to them, and appreciate them and love them. The story of Mark Wright, I was born in Wolverhampton, England, moved to Jamaica when I was 2 and a half, stayed in Jamaica until my 12th birthday, came to Washington, D.C. on my first airplane ride, May 7th, 1982, on the now defunct Eastern Airlines, landed in Washington, D.C., with my parents and my big sister Fiona, and we made D.C. our home, and I did middle school, high school in the DMV, obviously Howard University, and so that's sort of chapter one of the Mark Wright story.
So let me ask you, I always take my guests back to the beginning. What was the Wright household like? Mom and Dad, you spoke so fondly off them by sharing their 78th birthday 3 days apart. But what was the Wright household like in terms of family and foundation?
Well, you know, as I look back on our story, obviously you don't appreciate the story as you're telling it, as you're living it. But you know what they say about hindsight. As I look back, I mean, we might have been the Jamaican Huxtables. I mean, my mom was a nurse, so I still is a nurse. My dad was a welder by trade, and he was also a teacher, so he taught welding as well. We had a green Volkswagen that my dad shipped from the UK. Everybody knew about a red Volkswagen. We went to the beach every Sunday with family. We probably overloaded the car. We probably had more than the required amount of people in the car. But most Sundays, we were at the beach. Most weekends, you know, the house was full of music, and my dad playing John Holt and Jimmy Cliff, and my mom doing her two-step, and my dad was just a man's man in the house. I mean, we had a really, really fun household, and the house that I grew up in is the house that my parents live in right now, and the yard back then felt just massively big, and it just felt really big, and that's where I got my touches on the football and became, you know, the football star in my dreams that I hoped I would become. My big sister was a budding singer. I remember, I believe she was in her early teens. She went to Manchester High School in Mandeville, and I remember for a talent show, she sang the song "Someone Loves You, Honey," and I can't remember if she won, but for us, we were in the audience cheering her on. Mm-hmm. So that my upbringing was fun. We never wanted for anything. I got plenty of ass whoopings from my dad. My mom would say, "You wait till your father come home," and then you know he would come home, and he would pepper me good. He would pepper me once, and then my mom would say, "Okay, Derek, I think he's learned his lesson." And meanwhile, my dad's like, "I'm just getting warmed up." But we had a good household. We had a good, loving family, and it's great to recall those years.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you born in England, the UK. Moved to Jamaica at a young age, and for 12 years, or till the age of 12, you grew up in Jamaica. So coming to the United States as a preteen or early teen to Washington, D.C., your mom and dad still lives in Jamaica, you mentioned. So you came to D.C., did they come along with you, or what was that dynamic like? Because then you ended middle school and high school.
We all came as a family, four of us. Mm-hmm. And upon arriving, I think 2 years later, we arrived in 1982, and a year later my parents had a third child. So clearly they celebrated coming to America in their own way. coming to America was, if you can just follow me here. I mean, it was a dream. Mm-hmm. I mean, you remember as a child in Jamaica seeing, just all things America on your color TV, right? The mm-hmm. really, really purple grapes, the really, really red oranges, right? Mm-hmm. And everything in America just looked like, oh my God, if I could get a chance to go there, it would be a dream. So I'm 11 and 12 years old and getting that opportunity. And in the months leading up to coming to America, I remember walking to the square with my mom. We didn't have a phone in the home, so we'd have to walk out to the center square, mm-hmm. and get in line and get on the phone. And mm-hmm. I remember we would call my aunt here in America, as my mom's sister, who hosted us when we came here. And I remember my mom making those plans with my auntie, and you know, it would be, and of course, this is over the course of some years. And I remember as we got closer to the appointed time to come over, and it just so happened, it landed on my birthday. I don't think my parents were really planning to have me take my first plane ride on my birthday. But thank you, because May 7th, 1982 is a day I'll never, ever forget. What if I start forgetting that day, then really just, you know, stick a fork in, because
you're done.
The pot is done for sure.
So you come to the States, you envision the dream, and you come over, and you're now in middle school to high school years. What was that like? Was it much of a transition in terms of culture, in terms of preparation, in terms of was it what you expected?
No, it wasn't what I expected. And I remember, and I haven't talked to this, I haven't told this story to too many people. In fact, I can't even remember telling anybody this, but I struggled. I didn't struggle making friends, but I struggled sort of adapting to the culture. You know, there were times where, you know, I got made fun of with the accent, and granted, while it wasn't abuse, you know what I mean? I didn't seek therapy for it, but you know, I had my days where, you know, I really felt like I didn't fit in. I really felt like, you know, what can I do to make them like the whole me, not mm-hmm. just because I play football, not just because I'm black, not just because I want them to like all of me. And so, you know, those, you know, obviously preteen years for everybody's tough, but preteen years for black boys, my goodness. I mean, it's something that we don't talk about much, but I remember having a tough time. And I think I started turning the corner in my high school years. In the first school that my parents enrolled me in was a Christian school in Fairfax, Virginia, which I have some fond memories of that, but I mean, you can just imagine the shift. So you grow up in Jamaica, and everybody you see, for the most part, looks like you. Everybody from the prime minister down to your teacher. Mm-hmm. And then you come to America, and you're put in an environment where you are the minority in every single conceivable way. And you're just expected to just get over it and fit in with your accent, you know? Mm-hmm, and now that I think about that, I mean, that was hard on a young boy. But I think I hit my stride, or at least started to find myself a little bit as I got older, probably by, I would say, 10th or 11th grade. By then, my folks had switched me to a school closer to home. I grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland. And I went to Springbrook High School, mm-hmm. and I got a part-time job, and I started playing, you know, football. And I think that's when I started kind of coming into myself and kind of finding my voice.
Mm. Springbrook High. I used to live in Silver Spring as well, so that's a really good school. And so high school, you made it through. You adjusted. You adapted. All of the things that you mentioned, that even as young adults coming to the United States, that's a shock for everyone, the culture shock, the jolt that you get. But you went to Howard University, the Mecca. So just down the street, down Georgia Avenue, you went to Howard University. Tell us a little bit about that experience and what Howard meant to you then and what Howard means to you now.
It's funny. I'll tell you a quick story about actually how I got to Howard. And for those of your listeners who have kids who are looking to go to college, or if you remember their experience of choosing a college, you know, it's a fun time for a young person. And for me, I'm not going to say it wasn't fun. I mean, I'll just say this, though. I don't remember making a list of schools that I wanted to go to. And here's why. So my mom was a nurse at Howard University Hospital.
Oh.
And yeah. So, and my sister, my big sister, Fiona, would actually end up being an account exec. She sold, you know, ads for radio stations at WHUR, Howard University Radio, on campus as well. So at one point, we had three Howard people in the right household representing Howard in some capacity. But let me back up. So really, there was no question which college I was going to go to, particularly since back in those days, when your parent or your guardian worked for the university, there was remission of tuition. Mm-hmm. And let me just explain what the word remission of tuition or that freak means to an immigrant family. Boy, your college is paid for. You hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Your college mm-hmm. is paid for. So I was going to Howard. And that was the end of that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm,
I
mm-hmm.
might have dreamed of going to the West Coast, but no, that dream that done. I was going to Howard. I didn't really realize the significance or the importance of that until I got there.
Mm-hmm. So you get to Howard. What was that like? I know your household kind of prepared you, and getting to Howard, now that you're a freshman, it does something to a young person. I think all of us went through it, getting on the yard for the first time and seeing this rich tapestry of people of African descent. But what did it mean to you, and what did Howard mean then, and what does it mean to you today?
So I think, and for those of us who went to Howard will feel me on this. So I'm in Silver Spring, Maryland. I didn't live on campus, so I commuted from Silver Spring to Howard. So I took the 22 ride-on bus to Silver Spring Metro, and then took the 70, the 71, or the 72 up George Avenue every single day, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I know your listeners are like, yep, mm-hmm. The 718 bus, if you missed that one, you got to catch the 857.
Nice.
So that was me going to campus early and just staying there all day. Even if your classes finish by 3, you just stay there till 8 and you're at Founders, or you're at Blackburn, you're at Crampton. You're just kind of walking around. All your meals you eat there. So it's really just a home away from home. And it was actually something my parents couldn't understand. So let me get this straight. School finished 5 o'clock. Yeah. And at 9:30, you're just a reach one. So it was a time and a transition for everybody. And you could just imagine me explaining to them, look, Dad, Mom, school is not just about class. School is about, you know, an environment and culture and soaking all that up. Soaking it all up, huh? Okay. So it took us a while to really get to that. And that, too, was also part of my growth and my development. But I would say the first 2 years, my first 2 years at Howard, if I'm truthful and candid, my first 2 years at Howard, I didn't truly appreciate the experience like my last 2 years at Howard.
Mm.
My last 2 years at Howard, I started feeling myself, right? I started seeing my potential. I started understanding that, look, you're not just here to hang out and have a good time. It's not just a fashion show, which we all know it is. But you got to figure out what the hell you want to do with your life, and what is your calling, and what are you good at, and stop pursuing things that you don't have a passion for. And that didn't happen for me until junior year, where, you know, I had my one of my journalism professors, Dr. Larry Kagwa, who would say to me, and he called all his kids, his sons and his daughters, son, what are you doing? And when he would ask that question and you don't have the answer, he knows you don't have the answer. It's rhetorical. You know, what are you doing? Figure it out. And it wasn't until junior year that light bulb went off for me.
Wow. So Howard means so much to so many people, and the HBCU experience in general. But do you think that the last 2 years, as you mentioned, was enough to push you to where you are today in your career, or was all of it preparatory, but at the time you didn't realize that you were being honed and shaped into something that would give you a foundation on which you stand today? Because, you know, some people go through the college and university experience and they finish and they wonder, what did I just go through? I just went through this to get a job. But you used the word that made my ears perk up. You said your passion. Did Howard enliven your passion for what you're doing today?
So the quick answer is yes, right? And again, I'll reiterate, junior year and senior year. So things may have changed by now in terms of requirements and what's required. But I remember you had to graduate, you had to have, you know, one internship or maybe two, but one internship. I finished with 8 internships by the time I was done.
Wow.
And the reason for that is I realized that there were so many opportunities to be had that, you know, most people just weren't taken advantage of. Mm-hmm. So one internship led to another. The very first internship that I had was a writer-reporter internship at the Oakland Tribune in California. Mm. I remember I'd never been to California. Never been to California in my life. And I remember my professors selecting me as the student to represent the school communications to go to do this. I remember telling my parents, I just got chosen to do this program. And it freaked my parents out. You know, the first thing I said was, well, how long is it? I'm like, it's the whole summer. Where are you going to live? I'm going to find a place. How are you going to get to and forth, back and forth to work? I'm going to have to figure it out. But this is what it is, right? And I did. And that internship led to another internship. The following summer, I was at the Detroit Free Press. And the following summer, I did a local internship at Knight Ritter, and then another one at Gannett in Arlington. And I just kept getting these opportunities, and I quickly realized that, okay, so if I just continue raising my hand and asking questions, it's this easy. Like, it's this easy. All I have to do is open my mouth and be relevant, just like on the football field. You're not going to get the ball if you don't ask for it.
Right.
Okay, how nice you are. You got to open up, and you got to get open. And I did that, and that was the lesson that I learned. And I'll also say this. I was not the best student. I was not the top of my class, probably the top half of my class, but nobody worked harder. Hmm. Nobody.
Yeah.
Nobody was more driven. Nobody was more passionate. And that's when I realized, that's when I keep telling you about finding myself, right? That's when I really big up my chest and said, listen, if there's a story to be had, I'm going to get it. There's an internship to be had and they're only picking one student, I'm going to be it. So I played the part. I wore suits to school. I only had a couple, but I switched up the pants and the shirt. Mm-hmm. I had a briefcase. I mean, I was literally like walking into the person that I wanted to be. And I also say this, not everybody liked me for it.
Really?
He think he something. Oh, he think he this, he think he that. And I'm not going to say that that didn't affect me, but it didn't stop me.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I knew that there were people that I aspired and wanted to be. Every time I saw Mike Wilbon at the Washington Post or on TV, he was in a suit. Every time I saw him talking to somebody, he looked like he was taking notes. So I said, you know what? That's the lane I want to be in. I'm going to have to start acting that way.
Mm.
And it you know, sometimes not everybody's going to like you trying to be something that you're not yet, but I'm going to get there.
And that word yet is very important. It's interesting you're saying this. I'm listening to you. And when I was doing my background, I kind of read up on you. You have on one of your web pages says, I'm paraphrasing, it says your parents pretty much know that you would end up telling stories. And is that contextually, that's what you're basically just saying just now. You wanted to be the best, whatever you're doing, gathering information and then sharing that information. Is that a fair assumption?
That is a fair assumption. And I'm glad you found that, because two things come to mind when I hear that, because I remember writing it. When I was a little boy growing up in the mid-70s, there was a time there where when we came out to Jamaica, it was my mom who brought us down. And then my dad actually went back to the UK for a couple of years, not a lot of years, maybe 2 or 3 years, if I'm getting my math right. Mm-hmm. And so for a while there, I was surrounded by my grandmother and my great aunt and two other aunts. So I was just surrounded by some really strong, powerful women who every night, you know, you would just sit around and they would just talk to each other and tell stories. And they rarely shushed me. They rarely shushed me and said, boy, go to your bed. It was okay. Now, if it got late, they shushed me. But they always let me sit around and participate in the storytelling, and they would ask me questions, right? And so, and you know, they would have me. It was okay to put on a show. Same thing with my sister, right? It was okay to put on a show. Whereas, you know, in that environment, sometimes culturally, you know, pick the Guanaya room and go. Don't you see big people talking? Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you can identify with that. But I wasn't. We just weren't shushed. And so as I grew up, I mean, I read the announcements in church, and you know, the announcements on the church bulletin, they're the same every Sunday and they're boring. So I would improvise. You know, I remember doing that. Sometimes the jokes worked. Sometimes they were maybe borderline inappropriate. But you know what? That's where I got my reps at. That's where I got the opportunity to actually speak, stand in front of a room, command attention for the, you know, 90 seconds I'm up there before I ask the pastor to come say a word. But I was never shy. I was never shy. And I understood that while you're up there, you're going to say something that you wish you wouldn't, or you're going to have a moment where you're literally up there, you know exactly what you're going to say, and then you just completely brain freeze. Like, that's going to happen too. And there are moments like that, but I think I got my training, my combine experience, if you will, hanging with my grandmother, hanging with my great aunts and the aunties, and being encouraged to just speak.
So, you know, and that's very, very interesting, because I often ask my guests, if where they are today, if it was a linear straight path, and I am batting 100 now, none of them have said it's a straight path. There's always some tangent and some measure of preparation or a derivative they never thought of until they were much older. But I preface this question with that little blur, because you went to Howard, you went through the journalism school, and you've graduated. Where did that take you next, with your passion now in tow, you knowing what you want to do? Where did you go next, and what was that experience like as you built your career?
Sure. You know, after I'll tell you a quick thing about the Oakland Tribune internship. There was a mentor there that I had. He was a newspaper columnist. His name was Jim Bainbridge. And I remember one of the first stories that I wrote. I'm feeling myself. I'm the guy from Howard University who got this internship. I'm nice. I remember the first article that I wrote, and he sat down and he started reading it. And he wrote, "By Mark Wright, I like it so far. Now let me read the rest of this." And from there, he ripped my story to shreds. Everything that I wrote and thought about for hours, he gave me every reason in the journalism book why it didn't work. So I had moments, and I have a lot more stories like that of where I was humbled. There were moments where I doubted the track that I was so passionate about, that I felt so sure that this is what I want to do. I've had people along my journey, along my path, which was a squiggly line, to your point, a squiggly line. Sometimes it went straight, then it dipped to the right. Then it turned back. I mean, it was holy padipan falba in the whole path of this thing.
Right.
So I get your question in terms of graduation. I was lucky. During my senior year, I had a part-time job at the Washington Post. I was a copy editor / writer. But really, as a copy editor, you go into work around, you know, 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the evening, and your job is to edit and to clean up and to put headlines on and to, you know, size the paper for all the sports of the night. And not a glamorous job, but it was a job that, you know, without that opportunity to do that, to actually edit, you know, sports writers who have been doing it for 20, 30 years, and I'm just fresh out of school doing that. I mean, that was just as I think back now, it was the experience of a lifetime. Mm-hmm. And very humbling as well, because you're so green, right? And I remember sitting in the newsroom and literally looking around and looking at people look at me and saying to themselves, why is he here, right? Mm-hmm. He doesn't belong here. He hasn't put in the time to be here yet. You know, he hasn't earned it yet. And you know what? I'm not going to say they weren't right, but that was the first job that I had. Soon after that job at the Washington Times, I got a job working for BET. BET had a
a couple of magazines. As you remember, Emerge magazine,
mm-hmm. yes.
and they also had, which was their, you know, Black Time magazine, if you will. They also had a magazine called YSB magazine, Young mm-hmm. Sisters and Brothers magazine, which was a magazine for about young people and music, sports, culture, finance, all of that. And I was a copy editor slash writer at that publication, which was I felt was like my real kind of breakout opportunity. It's also the place where I met my wife, who is also a journalist. And that's a separate podcast, but she moved into the company and sat, and I'm sure she asked human resources to sit her next to me, and which there was a little partition there. She could see me edit her work, and we've been married now 20-some years.
Okay. Interesting. So your career starts, and you had these opportunities. I'll say these blessings, because being a copy editor, so young, I would imagine, and green, I can just imagine the looks that you were getting. But so you started along this path in your career. Take us through some of the twists and turns, and we definitely want to get to you going back and producing this feature on the 1971 Howard team. How did that all come together? You already said it's a squiggly line, but if you can paint a picture for us, what was the impetus behind that as your career is moving along?
Yeah, so the squiggly line, if you're following the squiggly line, YSB, everything's great. In just under 2 years, that magazine folds, dies, runs out of money, and I don't have a job. Now I have to figure out, what am I going to do? The magazine breaks down. I end up getting an opportunity working for Black Enterprise magazine and copy editing and writing as well. I always wanted to write. As much as I loved copy editing, I always wanted to write and tell stories. But I will thank copy editing for coming into my life, because she made me a better writer. So shout out to copy editors everywhere, and to headline writers everywhere. So Black Enterprise, I was there for just a little under or just a little over 2 years. And then a very good friend of mine, of ours, who is still a great friend today, a fellow journalist, Kelly Smith Killian, she gave me a heads up that there was a new magazine that's being started, and then I should put my name in a hat. And that ended up being ESPN, the magazine. In New York as well, just up the road on 34th Street. And one thing led to another. There was just some angels put in front of me, and my resume got forwarded. And, you know, it wasn't the job that I made the most money, but it was the job that literally got me to where I am today. Mm. The relationship that I have or had with ESPN, so I put in 15 years of my career, worked the lion's share of my career at ESPN. But when I was at ESPN magazine, I was only there for about 2.5 years. I was green and eager and wanted to do what I wanted to do, and I wasn't getting any opportunity. And I remember telling the then president of the general manager of the magazine, who ended up being the president of the company, John Skipper, who was a mentor then and continues to be a mentor and a great friend today. I remember saying, John, there's things I want to do. I'm not getting a chance to do it here, and I don't want to wait. And I remember John telling me, well, Mark, you know, sometimes you gotta get in line and you gotta wait. And I'm like, look, I'm seeing other people not getting in line and getting their shot. So I'm going to leave. And I remember John saying to me, like it's yesterday, he said, I see I can't stop you, so I'm not going to stop you, but you've done enough here to impress me and impress a lot of people. Go out there, go succeed or fail. And whatever happens, if you ever want to come back, come back. Wow. And after 3 years of working for four magazines, figuring out publishing, as publishing was dying and digital was on the rise and magazines were dying on a vine, after 3 years of that, I ended up calling John again and said, okay, John, I learned everything. Can I come back? And I ended up here in Charlotte, North Carolina, where I worked for ESPN Events, and then had the opportunity to work for ESPN Films, And really, that's when the opportunity to work on the film that you referenced, Redemption Song, about Howard University winning a national championship first in 1971 and then in 1974. That's really how that came about. And really, I mentioned Springbrook High School before, and I mentioned feeling like it was the beginning of me coming into my own as an immigrant boy. It took me just, you know, 5 or 6 years to kind of feel myself. My high school soccer coach is Ian Bain, and I've never done a podcast or done an interview without mentioning his name in some kind of way. Mm-hmm. And if he's listening, he's probably turning it down now because he's heard this story so much. Mm. But I'm sorry, coach, in advance. But Coach Bain is just one of those people, and he also taught Spanish at Springbrook. He was just one of those people that if you had him as a teacher, or if you had him as a coach, or he was just your homeroom teacher, he made an impact on your life. Hmm. And he did that. And I remember, and so that same Ian Bain was the star captain on Howard's 1974 national championship team, championship winning team. And I remember playing for Coach Bain. I only played for him for 1 year, but that's 1 year I'll never forget. Hmm. I remember many, many opportunities that Coach Bain could have said, you know, guys, we have a situation here. We're down 1-0, or this team looks tough. You know, when I was a player, when I was a national player, All-American at Howard University, I had this experience. So here's what you need to do. He never did that. He never told us about his journey. He never used his life as an example to uplift ours. He never bragged on himself. So fast forward, I'm now working. We reconnect in 2014. And I'm like, hey, coach, long time, no see, no hear. How you doing? He said, yeah, I was just enshrined in the Howard University Hall of Fame. And it was a really good event. And I'm like, what? Man, if I'd known about this, you know, I would have been there. And he said, well, it was all right. It wasn't bad. And he's telling me about his journey, about his freshman year where Howard University won a national championship and in 19 beating St. Louis, which was, you know, a national powerhouse at the time, the New York Yankees of college soccer at the time. Mm-hmm. And in 1972, the NCAA stripped Howard of that title, you know, accusing Howard of using ineligible players and stripping them. And again, you got to remember these teams are made up of Caribbean, Jamaican, Trinidadian, players from the diaspora. We looked different. We were playing the game, running circles around these mostly all white teams and, you know, dancing on the ball, rhythmic, just making the soccer world stand up and pay attention. And it didn't go over well with a lot of people. And my coach was there during this time. Howard University got stripped. And as part of the sanctions in the 1973 season, they were barred from postseason play. And so Lincoln Phillips, who's the head coach, who I have gotten to know and respect and love like a father figure through the process of making this film, he said, look, we got to win this championship back, not just for Howard, but for all HBCUs around the country.
Wow.
And in 1974, the team did that with my coach as captain, beating the same team that beat them in 1971 in quadruple overtime. Wow. And when Coach told me that story, right, I'm like, so wait, this happened? He's like, yeah. I'm like, Coach, this is a 30 for 30. He said, yeah, if you think so. I'm like, Coach, no, this is a 30 for 30. And so not working with the ESPN Films Group at the time, I wrote a treatment and met with the editor who eventually directed the film, gave it to him, and he ran it up the flagpole. And they said, wow, this is an okay story. I mean, it's all right. I don't know if it's a full-on 30 for 30. We'll give you some money to make a short film. And I had to swallow my anger, swallow my pride in that moment, because I saw plenty of other films hitting the airways that didn't compare in terms of story and impact. But I took the little trappances that they gave me. And we made that film, called it Redemption Song. And the film came out in June of 2016. And to this day, I still get emails from people from all around the world telling me and Ken and Holly, the director, how this film still makes them cry and how it continues to make an impact and how further they did not know this story.
Well, you know, one of the reasons why I was so excited that you were going to join us is for this exact same portion of this podcast interview today. I view Redemption Song as something I'm similarly trying to do here, is to tell a story and have the story to inspire others. So I'm going to switch a little bit on you and ask you this question. As you spoke with your coach, Coach Bain, and you were putting this film together, you must have had some revelations about, you know, the journey that folks are on in general and, you know, the HBCU experience, people of color, etc. If you had your druthers around ways in which you can use this story to inspire, what would be the meta narrative within this story that you could share with young people who say, you know, they're in the rural parts of Jamaica or they're in the inner city of Chicago or Baltimore? What meta narrative from this story would you lift out to share with them? Because this is, as you said, people call from around the world and said this feature made them cry. But there's a meta narrative there. And what would that be if, as the producer, what that meant to you?
Thank you for asking that. And it's very simple. And here it is. Redemption Song, the film, is about a group of people, a group of young men who didn't even realize the moment that they were in control of. They were just a couple of boys going to school. Some of the guys on the team weren't even recruited, at least in the early years. Mm. Howard University is the mecca. They're just going to get an education. And this is post-Civil Rights America. This is 1970s America, which, it's 2020, looks a lot like 2020 America. That's another podcast. But I think here's what it is. It's about falling down, dusting yourself off, getting back up, and saying to yourself, I might fall down again, but I'm going to win. Mm-hmm. Right? And I might not win on my first attempt or my second attempt or my third attempt, but I'm going to win. And in the process of making this film, and I tell my kids will always hear me say this, having a healthy dose of anger, a healthy dose of anger. When it's unhealthy, you do bad things to yourself and to other people. When it's healthy, you're driven. And I knew that the good folks at ESPN, and I'll call them the good folks because I spent 15 years of my life there and still have many great friends there. When they gave me the funds to make this film, I knew it wasn't enough to make a film that would really make an impact. And that angered me, right? Mm-hmm. But then I twisted that and said, you know what? I'm going to make it work. And I'm going to do my best in partnership with my director partner, Ken and Holly. We're going to make a kick-ass film here, and we're going to show them. Mm. We're going to show them that HBCUs matter. We're going to show them that black guys have been playing and gals have been playing this sport, the most popular sport in the world, and we're good at it, and we matter, and our stories matter. That's the kind of anger, a healthy dose. Some days I might have had an unhealthy dose, but for the most part, that's the type of mentality that I had going in. So to that young person in Jamaica, in Trinidad, in Chicago, in Silver Spring, Maryland, whatever your circumstances might be, right? Whatever your circumstances might be, your book is not yet written. It is not completely written. And you need to do your best to look around and see who you're surrounded with, right? If you're surrounded with people, friends, even family, who cannot help you elevate, stop hanging out with those people. Stop talking to those people. Start looking for other people who can uplift you. And the process of making Redemption Song, really, and this was just 4 years ago, and I started this by saying I don't want to sound preachy. Really, I'm still on my journey. I'm still on my path, and it's still squiggly, and I still have my days where I take my L's, right? My losses.
Mm-hmm.
But it really, this process really ignited a fire in me to tell stories of uplift, which is why, you know, I appreciate what you're looking to do here. It's not just to get people on here who have done this and done that and been here and traveled that. Nobody gives two rats about that. Nobody cares about that. They want to hear, hey, I listened to this guy, Mark Wright, talk, and while he talked a little bit too much and his stories were a little too long, I got this from him.
Mm-hmm.
I got this one nugget from him. And I can honestly tell you that that's what Redemption Song did to me. That did for me. And I continue to tell stories like that. There's a common thread with every story that I either write or tell with video. And it's all about falling down, getting back up, and winning. That's the common thread with every story. And if you don't like that, then you're not going to like the work I produce.
Well, I can tell you, Mark, it's very interesting, the work that you're producing, because right now we're in the midst of a global pandemic, and you know, unemployment is rising, and there's a lot of anxiety and stress. And those are the kinds of stories that we need, you know, to give hope and give inspiration and give, say, hey, there's a way out of this. But as you think about your career and where you are, you're a relatively young man. Your squiggly lines are still being drawn. But if you had to focus on something that you want to be an end game, what would be next for you, or the next squiggly line that you're drawing? Is there a next squiggly line that you're drawing? And what does that do for the legacy or the vibration that you're trying to leave in this earth?
Wow, that's a big one. I think, you know, for a lot of us and for a lot of my friends and family, it, you know, the thing you want to do is you want to go to school, get a career, you know, get good employment, provide for your family, and live a good life, right? Of course, everybody wants that. But I think what we need to add to that, or at least what I'm looking to add to that is working at building some kind of legacy. So tomorrow is not promised. We do this podcast today, and I'm gone tomorrow. And what have I left behind for my kids? And in 2015, you know, my wife and I had a bit of an epiphany. Where I think in 2015, actually in the midst of Redemption Song, I was one of a couple of hundred ESPN people who were laid off because of some cutbacks. And I remember in that moment being, you know, highly regarded. I did good work. People liked me. But I just remember, hey, man, you know, your number came up and you got to go. And I remember kicking down pictures off my wall in my office and cleaning off my laptop and taking two boxes and leaving. 8 years of hard work and great memories, and all I had was two boxes.
Wow.
And I remember that feeling of, what do I have? What do I have that's tangible that I can leave for my kids? And I had nothing. And then in the months after that, we launched our marketing and production company, Wright Creative. And we launched it just so we could feel like, you know what, at least this is something. It's a business, it's a company, it's what we do, and it's something we can leave behind for our kids. We might not be able to build it as high as we want it to go. But if we leave here today, our kids can, and their mm-hmm. kids can. Mm-hmm. And that's what I got out of that experience. And I'm happy to say that, several years ago, my wife who had felt that she had gotten to as far as she had gotten in corporate, felt that she was making a lot of money for other people. And she felt like, you know what, I'm going to do this for me. So now we have committed ourselves to making Right Creative something is more than just something to leave behind. We're going to make the next time we do a podcast, I'll have stories to tell that Right Creative has produced, you know, several documentaries. Mm-hmm. And we have several big brands as clients. And this is not just wishful thinking. This is just where we are in the next chapter of our careers, where we were happy to have worked for ESPN. We're happy to have had big clients, but now it's time to actually take those experiences and make it work for us. And man, really, and that's kind of where we are. All the lessons and all the falls and all of those things have gotten us to this point. And I say that with no braggadocio. I'm thankful for all of them. Thankful for every opportunity that we've fallen down and skinned our knees. It's gotten us to this point, and I'm grateful for that.
Wow. So we have about 7 minutes left. And I'm going to do with you as I've done with all of my guests, because one of the things that people had one guest say to me, but I know, Gerald, I'm not an inspirational person. And he left us with an inspirational thought that has stuck with me the entire time. But as I listen to you speak today and me asking you these questions and your responses, I hearken back to something you said close to the beginning. You said you used to read the church announcements. So there must have been some measure of spirituality and faith there, either from your aunt, your grand aunt, your grandmother, etc. Do you see that element of your faith being a common thread through the middle of the squiggly lines? And that's part one. And part two, if that is the case, I'm going to ask you to share just some words of inspiration and encouragement for the young people listening and the young adults who are starting out their careers that listen to this podcast, for you to share, just words to uplift and inspire them to keep them going in this environment we're in. You talked about losing employment, being laid off, et cetera, but you bounced back just like the Howard soccer team. So as we get to draw to close this discussion today, if you'd be so inclined to share some words that will leave a vibration, if you will, on this podcast.
In the spirit of what this podcast is about, which is to inspire and inspiration, I'll say this to your listeners. You know, I am still that 8-year-old boy in Jamaica, the 8-year-old boy who read the Psalms and at my Auntie Monica's funeral when I was 8 years old in front of the church. And I remember breaking down in the middle of that session. I'm 8. I remember that. And I remember the aunties and the elders coming up to me, basically to like, oh, he's going to break down. He's not going to finish. And I remember as an 8-year-old brushing them back off and saying, nope, I'm here and I'm going to finish reading the scripture. Auntie Monica would want me to do that. And I finished it. That was a moment for me to fall and get up and finish. And I've had a lot of those moments. And I'm glad that this is the question you're asking at this point as we wrap, because it's not an opportunity for me to talk about traveling the world and interviewing this celebrity and this athlete and another, because none of that matters. In this moment, I think about my wife, who is an 8-year breast cancer survivor. Mm. And I remember looking at her when she was all bandaged up and having the thought that, oh shit, I'm losing my wife. What am I going to do? And to see her look back at me and said, look, can't do this without you, bro. I know I'm all bandaged up over here, but these things going to heal and I'm going to be fine. But we need you, bro. So whatever you need to do, right? Feel sorry for yourself. Be mad at your friends for reaching out and checking on you. And you want to crawl into your little manhole where you're quiet, do it. But you're going to have to get out of that real soon. And I did that. So I'll just say this to your listening audience. You're going to have those moments. And when you have an opportunity to be interviewed on your own podcast, you got to think about what those chapters are in your life where you fell down and skinned your knees. I don't want to hear about the times that you got 50,000 likes on an IG post. Those things don't matter. It's the moments when you fell down and then got back up and said to yourself, I'm not going to lose today. I'm going to align myself with people who can help me win. I'm going to raise my hand and ask questions, because if I don't ask for the ball, I ain't going to get it. And regardless of where you are, this is not about being rich, poor, black, white. Regardless of where you are, there's a door that you can go to that will lead you to success. And we can quantify that success. Success doesn't mean riches, right? And you have to be open to finding that door and finding people who can help you get there. Mm-hmm. So I'll just leave you with that word of encouragement. Please know that you're going to fall down more times than you get up. But just make sure the last time is you getting up and saying, I'm not going to lose today. I'm going to do everything in my power to succeed today.
So well said, sir. Very, very powerful. And the imagery and the metaphors you used. Well, Mr. Wright, we're at time. And I want to say, first and foremost, I'm extremely humbled that you took some time to spend with little old me and what we're trying to achieve here. Your words today shared were definitely hit a core with me. Oftentimes people say, well, Gerald, sometimes you go quiet. I go quiet because what is being shared actually is cutting, slicing and dicing at the same time. So I want to thank you for that, sir. And just sharing those stories and the inspiration. I'm pretty sure now Redemption Song is something that I'm going to share with my listeners again, for those who have not seen it yet, to make sure they check it out. And I want to continue to say to you, just keep doing what you're doing. And, you know, people are watching, and I'm looking forward to what will come from your creative writing agency with you and your wife. So thank you so much for joining me today, sir.
Thank you very much for having me. I hope I didn't eat up too much of the time.
No, you were spot on. You were spot on. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's episode of It's Easy, Son. I trust and I pray always that something was shared here today that inspires and gives you another lens through which to see your own circumstances. And as a result of that, you can see yourself in a different spot from where you sit today. So until next week, take care, have fun, and be safe. And more importantly, be better tomorrow than you are today. Take care.